following program is brought to you in living color on
DailyGazette.com or wherever you get your podcast.
The Daily Gazette Company presents the Parting Shots Podcast. Now, here's your host, Daily Gazette sports editor, Ken Schott.
Thank you, Scott Giese, and welcome to the Parting Shots Podcast, available wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe today. Thanks for joining me from the Parting Shots Podcast Studio in Schenectady, New York. Hard to believe it's mid-May. We're getting ready for another edition of the podcast here. Some great guests coming up. We're going to talk New York Yankees, New York Mets baseball. Those two teams will be facing off this weekend at Yankee Stadium in the Bronx. And we're going to talk to Carl Ravitch of ESPN. He covers the Major League Baseball Sunday night games for the network. He will be calling the call for Sunday's game between the Mets and Yankees. We sat down Thursday afternoon to chat about that. And I know Ravi from his days when we were working together for a few months in 1990 in the South Central Pennsylvania area, the York, Lancaster, Harrisburg market. He was a sportscaster at Channel 27 there in Harrisburg. And we had Carl on a couple of years ago, and our good friend Greg Mace, who was a sports director of Channel 27, who had passed away. And Carl remembered a story about Greg encouraging him to take a job at ESPN because Greg wanted to stay local. He was happy with doing that, and more power to Greg for doing that. And so, Carl Ravitch has been at ESPN a long time, does baseball, does it well, does also college basketball. So we're going to talk with him about this weekend's matchup there at Yankee Stadium. And, of course, it's Preakness this weekend, and unfortunately no Triple Crown as Sovereignty, the Kentucky Derby winner, will not run in Saturday's race at Pimlico Racetrack in Baltimore. But Mike McAdam will be there to cover, and he'll talk about the impact of that as well as preview the race on Saturday. The last one at Pimlico, under its current configuration, they're going to demolish the stands and build a new facility, and they'll run the Preakness next year at Laurel Race Course down in Laurel, Maryland, just a few miles from Washington, D.C. So we'll talk to Mac about the Preakness on his At the Track with Mac segment. So coming up, before we go, I want to reminisce about something. This past Sunday, May 11th, marked the 40th year since I graduated from York College of Pennsylvania. I can't believe it's been that long. And time flies, and I had wonderful memories of my time at York. And, of course, the man you hear introduce this podcast, Scott Giese, he was a classmate of mine, a great friend of mine. We hit it off right away when we first met at the college radio station, WVYC, and I met a lot of great people there. Some of my best friends are from college. I keep in contact with either, by phone, text, social media. So I would never regret it going to York. I mean, I applied to four when I was my senior year of Holy Ghost Prep in suburban Philadelphia, Ben Salem, Pennsylvania. I applied to four colleges. I applied to York. I applied to Temple. I applied to Allentown College. I think it's another name now. I'm not sure what it is. And I was sort of an off-the-wall pick, Marquette out in Milwaukee. I really wanted to go to Temple, and I got a tour of the facilities. I wanted to get involved in radio, and Temple has a great media program. But I was told during my tour that I would not be able to get on their radio station until my junior year. So, okay, that's no biggie. We'll figure something out. So in all the acceptance letters and all stuff, I was just accepted by three colleges. I was accepted by York, I was accepted by Allentown, and accepted by Marquette. I was rejected by my hometown college, Temple University, and I think it had a lot to do with my SATs. I had great grade point average when I was in high school, but for some reason those SATs got me. I don't know why. I don't know if it was nervousness or not, but somehow I just didn't really do well in those SATs. I think that came back to bite me as far as Temple, but you know what? Temple's loss was York College of Pennsylvania's gain. I had a great experience involved in college radio, involved with the men's and women's college basketball teams, either as a statistician or calling games on our college radio station. Did baseball, a statistician for a couple years there, and a statistician a couple years for the women's volleyball team. And it was just, and of course, I started my journalism career during my junior year at York, at the York Daily Record, and that blossomed into what I'm doing right now. And it's in doing, being able to do this podcast, sort of brings me back to my college radio days. And it's just, A lot of great memories. In fact, I'm going to get together with some of my friends in a couple of weeks. We're going to go see the Cubs play the Phillies down in Philadelphia, and that'll be a great chance to catch up with some of my buddies, Scott Giese, Joe Torn, and Matt Skiles. So it'll be fun to hang out and cheer the Phillies on. Well, Joe Torn's a Cubs fan, so I don't think he'll be cheering the Phillies on. And I know Scott is an Orioles fan, so he'll remain neutral. But so coming up, we're going to talk baseball with Carl Ravitch, and it's the Yankees-Mets series. You're listening to the Parting Shots podcast.
If you really want to know what's going on in your community, you have to read the Daily Gazette. We don't take a side. We're right down the middle, and we're going to get to the truth. Our reporters and photographers are out in the field bringing you updates every minute with trust, accuracy, and integrity from the first page to the last page, independent, probing journalism. We're finding out what's going on in the community where nobody else is covering. It's who we are. It's what we do.
Hi, this is Joe Watson, two-time Stanley Cup champion with the Philadelphia Flyers. You're listening to Parting Shots podcast with Daily Gazette sports editor and upstate New York's number one Flyer fan, Ken Schott. Make sure you tune in.
Welcome back to the podcast. The New York Mets and New York Yankees will be facing off this weekend at Yankee Stadium in the Bronx, and both teams are on fire right now. And the third game of that series will be on Sunday Night Baseball at the ESPN, and the man who will be calling that game along with David Cohn and Eduardo Perez is Carl Ravitch, a man I've known since 1990 when he came to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, while I was still working at the York Daily Record. Carl, good to catch up with you. How are things going?
Everything is great. Pleasure to be on with you. Always excited to talk to Central Pennsylvania folks. Of course, Little League World Series coming up in a few months, but Yankees-Mets is a little different. Makes it very special for us on a Sunday night to have that game.
Yeah, I like the fact that it's going back to the three-game series. I know for the last few years there's been a two-game midweek series, and it seems to lose a little bit of luster, but to have it on the weekend, and also both teams in first place in their respective divisions, the excitement is probably over the top right now.
Yeah, I mean, the storylines are phenomenal. They're both playing really well. The Yankees have able to deal with injuries. The Mets have the number one pitching staff in baseball, which is very odd given who they have on that staff right now and how that's come to be. The Soto-Judge thing is fantastic. Alonso is hitting the hell out of the baseball. And it goes on and on. We had our Thursday morning conference call to sort of prepare. I think we spent 30 minutes on Judge and then another 30 on everybody else. So it's got as many storylines as you can imagine, and it's a unique environment. And I think even more so at Yankee Stadium. David Cohn, of course, was on the broadcast with us Sunday. He was on the call this morning. He played for both teams. We're maybe doing a piece on what it's like to be booed at Yankee Stadium. He knows what that's like, especially actually wearing a Red Sox uniform. Unique environment. Looking forward to it Sunday, no doubt.
You mentioned Aaron Judge. I mean, he's a certified first ballot Hall of Famer. There's no doubt about that, the way his career is going. But what he's doing right now in 43 games, you know, forget the home runs, forget the RBIs. He's batting .412. When does the talk start about can Aaron Judge be the first major
hitter? That's a great question, because that question was brought up this morning. When do we start the 400 conversation? I don't know how many of your listeners are real diehard baseball fans, but if they're inclined to read, there's a great article on FanGraphs, it's called. That's GARPHS. About what the decision making is when it comes to pitching to Aaron Judge. Are we at a Barry Bonds level where you just don't pitch to him? He's getting on base at an absurd clip. His weighted runs created plus is Ruthian. The peripheral numbers are better than most of the numbers that old school folks tune into, except for batting average, which is a very easily recognizable 400 number. You know, this is reserved for the Gwynns and the Luis Arizes of the world, not for a 6'7", 280-pound power hitter. And yet, he's doing it. His maturity at the plate has changed a little bit. His plate discipline has changed dramatically. He was a guy that when he stood in there early in his career, you knew a good right-handed pitcher who had a slider was going to strike him out. He was going to swing and miss, and he would be out. He's become far more, mature and doesn't swing necessarily at pitches that he once would have. He's He's just he's a much better hitter than he was. He always was a power hitter, but he's a much better hitter now than he ever was. And it's, you know, those evolutions of these players is a real cool thing to watch. I mean, Alonso, who had a very good year and has had three really good years, claims that there was room for improvement. We all saw it. He knew it based on his contract in the offseason. He's changed a little bit, more mature, discipline, plate discipline, body mechanics, all sorts of ISO and plyometrics in the offseason. You know, it sounds like air traffic control dealing with these guys and the shit that they cover and work on, but it's paying off, and I love when it pays off. Trent Grisham's another guy, overshadowed by the giant next to him, but Trent Grisham's another guy. Look at what he's done this year for the Yankees.
Yeah. And then, I mean, really an under the radar signing was Paul Goldschmidt. He's
100%.
346 batting average. He seems to found himself there at Yankees with the Yankees, and it just seems like anybody the Yankees signed, they seem to find themselves.
Yeah, a lot of them. I mean, not, you know, look, they've had some misses, there's no doubt about it. But in Goldschmidt's case, this seems to be a perfect marriage. He's not an attention seeker. There's plenty of guys on that team that will take the spotlight away from him. He is your typical lunch pail, let me do my job. He did work on a variety of things in the offseason. But the idea that these guys work on a variety of things in the offseason is hardly new. He's been doing that his whole life. It's just this season, it seems to, whether it's the lineup he's in, the uniform he puts on every day. I do believe there's something to players when they wear a Yankee uniform or a Dodger uniform. There is a level of respect for the organization, the city, the ballpark, that, if possible, can work to help elevate their game. And Goldschmidt was not very good. Neither was Arenado the last couple of years. And both of them are having, you know, really good seasons. But Goldschmidt is, you know, he's exactly what they needed when Stanton got hurt and has filled in, and his ability to get on base is spectacular. And they got guys who don't ruffle feathers either. You know, one thing about the Captain Judge is like the Captain Jeter. He seems to be able to avoid any situation that's going to cause anxiety for himself or for the team. He stays out of trouble. Goldschmidt will stay out of trouble. That's a big deal in New York City.
Yeah. And you mentioned Pete Alonso. That was the, I think a lot of Mets fans were worried what was going to happen with Alonso, because the way they acted towards Pete in the postseason, they were thinking this was the last they were going to see him as a New York Met, but the Mets did re-sign him, and he's, you know, having a great season, batting .311, 9 homers, 36 RBI. So it seems like that was a smart signing, re-signing, to not let him go somewhere else.
Yeah, a lot of these decisions, certainly in the case of Judge, it ultimately came down to the owner. I think in the case of Alonso, as much as there's some deferential treatment to David Stern by Steve Cohen, I think Cohen realized how important, you know, the polar bear and Alonso is to that uniform and to that team and to that city. He's amazingly engaged in the community with his contributions to Tunnel to Towers and other things like that. And look, there's just not many who produce consistently the way he does. Like, we at some point, you have to just wonder, like, why wouldn't we re-sign a guy that's given you 30 plus and 100 plus every year? Like, why wouldn't we do that? It's not an affordable issue. They can afford, and he can afford anything. So it's a great story. I'm happy for him, you know. And again, one of the conversations is Aaron Judge underpaid given what Soto is making? Clearly, there's an age difference. But where does Alonso fit in, having the good fortune to do Little League World Series, College World Series, and follow Major League Baseball the way I do? It's funny how the conversations change so radically. The Little Leaguers, it's about, my God, that kid is so good. I've never seen somebody that good at age 12. In college, it's like, that guy's a pro. He stands out. Now they're getting paid. And at the pro level, it's, how much are we paying him to do what? Like, he's making – so it's neat to see all three different levels. And Alonso is a guy who certainly seemed worth that year, that one-year investment, and we'll see what happens in the offseason.
Of course, you mentioned Juan Soto. Obviously, this is going to be – interesting how he's going to I think we know how he's going to be greeted when he makes his first plate appearance on Friday at Yankee Stadium. You know, he signed that 15-year, $765 million contract with the Mets, leaving the Yankees. I mean, George Steinbrenner is probably rolling over his grave if he figured somebody leaving the Yankees to sign with the Mets for that kind of money, and he wasn't signed. But Soto has not really lived up to it right now early in the season. He's batting .255. Is it one of those things, Carl, where they want to prove themselves and they're trying to do too much? I mean, I think Francisco Lindor is probably a good example of that. When he first started the Mets, he was trying to do too much and things got out of control and the fans hated him for a little while, but now he's a respected leader of that team.
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt that that's an internal pressure that players will put on themselves, especially when there's a big contract. And I think one of the things that happens in that city in particular, and maybe Anthony Volpe is a good example, he's always going to be measured against Derek Jeter, but he's also certainly in the current being measured against Francisco Lindor. Soto may currently be mentioned and measured against Judge. Judge is, obviously putting up comical season and ridiculous numbers, so it doesn't look like Soto's having a good year. So Soto's batting average is down a little bit, but all of his other metrics are up. The idea that Juan Soto is having a bad year is not true. He's having an above average year. He's not yet having a Juan Soto year, though there have been signs here recently of the power coming back. So I think there's just a multiple number of factors that go into a Juan Soto conversation. One is his own bar. The other is the Yankees. The third might be Judge alone. The fourth could be his own teammates in Alonso and Lindor. I think in the end, it will be a contract that, maybe years 9 through 15 look completely stupid. But for the next 3, 4, 5 years, it should pay off and should be great. And in the end of this season, he'll have the numbers. And we may, in a month or so, be having the conversation. So who do you want to have up right now in the big spot, Judge or Soto? Right now it feels like Judge. I think you can make the case for Soto anytime. I think he's, when he needs to get a hit or put a bat on a ball, I think he does that as well as anybody in the game.
Talk about the Mets pitching staff, because I think you mentioned that you were surprised how good they've been. Why is that?
I don't, whether Jeremy Hefner has been able to unlock a few of them. Clearly, the Clay Holmes experiment has paid off. Tyler McGill has been really good. Peterson, who we'll have on Sunday night, has been, above average. What they don't have are they don't have the Garrett Coles of the world. They don't have the all-star pitchers that you're used to seeing, and yet they're producing at an incredibly high rate. So I do think the science of pitching has changed so dramatically that you can take somebody who has, let's say, average stuff and throw them into a pitching lab and adjust their fingers and their grips and their grip pressure and their arm angle. And, for instance, you can take a C pitcher and turn him into a B-plus pitcher. You can take a B pitcher and turn him into an A-minus pitcher. And currently, there are certain organizations that succeed in doing that. The Cleveland Guardians have long been one. The Seattle Mariners have been one for a long time. The Pittsburgh Pirates made a living of turning, good pitchers, draft picks, into outstanding pitchers. Just look at the guys that have left that organization. Tampa Bay. Right now, the New York Mets are in one of those windows where they're turning chicken whatever into chicken salad. It's a nice thing to see for the Mets and their fans, because this was a team, at least in the beginning, that you were rooting for their offense to be really great and hope that Senga and the rest of them can carry their weight. But they've been shining.
Yeah. You mentioned Garrett Cole. Obviously, they lost him. The Yankees lost him in spring training, their ace, to Tommy John surgery. So how big was the Max Fried free agent signing now with
him? Yeah, and we'll have Fried Sunday. He's spectacular, and I think for people who didn't know Max Fried, they kind of saw what he was made of in Atlanta. But I'll be honest, I believe I heard stories when he signed with the Braves and they took him, there was some concern about his toughness. He's a California kid, went to a prestigious school. One thing about Fried is he is an absolute bulldog. We saw that in the World Series where he had a lousy game and then he bounced back the next time. People were wondering, what guy is going to show up here, and he shined for him. He's a competitor. He got a huge deal, and he seems to be very comfortable in New York, which is not an easy thing to do, and he's doing great. So I look forward to seeing him Sunday. He's a lefty, so that poses different issues for a lineup that has lefties in it, like Soto, because Fried's been so good. So we'll see. But having Max Fried is a massive – look, you need two or three frontline starters, I think, to win World Series. In a rare case, you can kind of get away with a bullpen game, but you need that number in order to win.
Yeah,
I think.
Since Steve Cohen bought the Mets a few years ago, how has the dynamic changed in New York baseball? Because, I mean, it was the Steinbrenners for years, obviously George Steinbrenner for years to spend the money. Yep. The Mets did it, but now Cohen's in there, and it seems like the Yankees are a little more cautious at how they spend money.
Yeah, it's a very legitimate question. Clearly a guy who has that money doesn't look at a budget the way that other people would. It had always been the Yankees' world that way financially. I do think that Brian Cashman is a little bit more reserved than you would find in guys who are underneath George Steinbrenner. But having the brother the son now run it, and Cashman has a big voice. Look, I'm not sure they were going to go where they did on Judge. Cashman was not willing to do that. It was Hal Steinbrenner who came in and said, let's make sure we do this. So there's an absolutely different dynamic. It's not only the Mets, it's the Dodgers who now have the financial wherewithal that a guy like Cohen has. It's different. It's not the Yankees' financial might anymore. There's clearly other teams that have the same. And it's changed the dynamic for Major League Baseball and for the Yankees, no question.
I think this topic came up on this past Sunday game being between the Phillies and the Guardians. It seems like official scoring is really different now. I mean, they're less inclined to give errors out. It seems like, and when they do, it seems like they get changed for some unknown reason. Does Major League Baseball have an official scoring problem?
If they do, I wouldn't think, for me personally, it's big enough to describe it as Major League Baseball has an official scoring problem. I think there are instances that pop up in games where, like, I'm sorry, like, that's an error. They gave him a double on a ball that literally went in and out of a guy's glove when he jumped early and kind of banged into the wall, but not nearly hard enough to dislodge it. That's an error. So I think there are just individual moments that come up in a game. I don't think there's a conspiracy theory, because I'm sitting next to a hitter in Eduardo Perez and a pitcher with David Cone, and I know when that double came up, Cone was delighted and Eduardo was pissed. Yeah. I'm sorry, Eduardo was delighted and Cone was like, wait a minute, that's an error. That ain't a double. I didn't give up a double. That's an error out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's having done it a couple times when I covered the Harrisburg Senators, and it just seems like there's, because of the contracts, and it seems like there's somebody out there who's watching these games who doesn't have a clue what baseball is all about.
Yeah, I think that's a little bit unfair. I mean, I could have this conversation with my friend Tim Kirkshin, who has been an official scorer. He's been an umpire. I think for the most part, I haven't seen conspiracy theory in that area or umpire area. I haven't. Maybe I'm naive. I was certainly naive around the performance-enhancing drugs years. I had no clue about that. But I just don't think that these guys are leaning into one area, and I think most of them are rooted in baseball.
Yeah. It was a big announcement earlier this week with Rob Manfred, the commissioner, taking Pete Rose and Shoeless Joe Jackson off the ineligible list. Now they're eligible for Hall of Fame. Was that the right move?
I was surprised by it. I don't think it was the right move. To me, permanently ineligible means permanently ineligible. Anybody that's been to Cooperstown knows that Pete Rose and his hit record and the Hit King are very well displayed in the museum. Does he need to be elected into the Hall of Fame? I wouldn't necessarily think so. I think he's there enough, and I was really surprised. I don't want to speculate on what changed or what led to that decision. But I think people can draw their own conclusions about it. I don't agree with it.
Yeah. Well, barring a last minute, and I'll be careful how I question this. I don't want to get you in trouble with your bosses here. But could be the last year of Sunday Night Baseball on ESPN. I think you during a conference call prior to the season, you said you were still optimistic that a deal will get done. Do you think a deal is going to get done with the Major League Baseball and ESPN to keep Sunday Night Baseball on?
Yeah, I'm optimistic until I'm told it's over and there is no future for Major League Baseball and ESPN. I'll say what I said, I believe, in the beginning of the season, before the season started, is that there's too many things that would make it work for both ESPN and Major League Baseball to be on the ESPN streaming platform. And I use the analogy of Noah's Ark. Every other sport animal is on the ark, and you can name sports they're on there. You can say NHL, NFL, NBA, college sports, golf, major champion, tennis. Like, they're all on there. So it just strikes me, if I'm running a sport, I want to make sure in some capacity, I'm not suggesting it's an automatic Sunday night baseball, but in some capacity, I got to have footing on that arc. I know that sports fans are buying it. And if they're buying it, it means they're exposed to our sport. What's going to be the biggest platform for our sport to be exposed? It's going to be ESPN. And I'll say the same thing about ESPN. We have the arc with every animal on it. Are we a complete circle without having Major League Baseball? I don't think so. Yeah. So we need to have Major League Baseball the same way I believe Major League Baseball needs to have ESPN. And I'm sure both sides will argue we don't need it. I use the word need. I think in order to complete each other's resumes, you both need it. And I'm trying to be objective in all of this, honestly.
I would like to see Baseball Tonight come back. I think that's sorely missed. If you have that every night, that was always a go-to, you know, before SportsCenter, before
I miss it badly. And maybe with the streaming platform, there's a way to do it. But you have to have an agreement with Major League Baseball in order to do something like that.
Well, Carl, I appreciate a few minutes. Hey, by the way, can you give me any inside tip that the Yankees Phillies game in late July, that Sunday afternoon, we moved to Sunday night?
Yankees Phillies, when is that, in late July?
Late July. Because I may try to go down with my son. So if we figure out to move to Sunday night baseball, that might help us a little bit.
I would imagine I can tell you this. I mean, our schedules are usually 4 to 5 weeks in advance. Much of it has to do with what else is going to be on. So the fact that there's no NFL yet, the NBA is over, the NHL is over. A Yankees-Phillies game certainly makes sense to be considered. I haven't seen the list, but I'd be hard-pressed to imagine it's not one of the options that we have.
Well, I hope so. That way, if I get down there, I'll say hello if I can get in near.
Yeah, please do.
Box. So, Carl, I appreciate it as always. Have fun Sunday with everybody, and we'll talk soon.
Great to be on with you again.
Hey, that's Carl Ravitch. Coming up, Mike McGann, previews the Preakness Stakes. You're listening to the Parting Shots podcast.
Hi, I'm Stan.
And I'm Shen.
And each week we bring you the Stan and Shen Show. And each week we talk about fun things through our travels throughout the capital region. We touch on food, we touch on news, try to touch heavily on good news. And Shen's always available with hot takes.
Yeah, so if you could follow along and listen to us every week on dailygazette.com or on all major streaming platforms, we'd love to have you join us.
Hi, this is Union College women's hockey alum Michelle Tardif. You're listening to the Parting Shots podcast with Daily Gazette sports editor Ken Schott.
Welcome back to the podcast. It's the second leg of a horse racing triple crown. Unfortunately, there won't be a triple crown this winter this year, as Sovereignty, the Kentucky Derby winner, decided to forego the Pimlico and get ready for the Belmont Stakes at Saratoga. And Mike McAdam will be covering the Preakness for us. He's here with me now in the Mac at the Track with Mac segment. And Mac, I mean, how disappointing is this?
It is to a lot of people, but it's also not a big surprise. If you look at the connections, Bill Mott's the trainer, Godolphin Racing from Dubai, they're the owners. They bred this horse. They have a lot of long-term interest invested in the horse. And, I mean, it's just not in Bill Mott's playbook to run a horse back in 2 weeks like this. So it's disappointing because everybody likes, you know, the kind of the hype and the fervor behind a potential Triple Crown attempt. But it's not surprising at all based on the people that are connected to the horse. I'm sure the two main disappointed parties are Pimlico because they don't get, you know, that extra buzz of a possible Derby Preakness double. I'm sure the New York Racing Association wasn't thrilled with it because then, you know, if Sovereignty had happened to win the Preakness, now all of a sudden the Belmont up at Saratoga on June 7th is just going to go through the roof with a Triple Crown in line. Assuming that Sovereignty would make it to all three races, it's just a difficult thing for horses to do these days.
We'll get into that in just a second, but I want to get your thoughts since you were down at Louisville for the Kentucky Derby. That was a muddy day, rainy day, and what did you think of that race?
I thought it was a great race. Sovereignty beat Journalism by a length and a half. So what was good about it over the last 6 years prior, just some weird things happened, long shots, disqualifications, and things like that. And this year, kind of the good horses that were supposed to run well ran well. I did not see a single person complain about the condition of the track, having walked on it myself a half an hour, like a couple minutes after the Derby. I can tell you that I still have Churchill Downs mud caked to my hiking shoes, which probably won't go anywhere fast at the Preakness this weekend. But I didn't hear anybody complain about it. I didn't hear anybody use it as an excuse. Churchill Downs generally dries out pretty quickly, although it never had a chance to, because it's just like not only all day, but pretty much most of the week there was some form of moisture in the air. At least it was not sunny out. So it was kind of, you know, they still got 147,000 people there. Yeah. So rain did not scare any of them away from their mint juleps and their.
How many were actually?
Oh, that's hard to say because I'm not a good gauge of. You know, I can go to Saratoga and tell you when 25,000 might be a line of a bull. But the difference between 147,000 and, let's say, a lot of no-shows and only 120,000 at Churchill Downs, I think it's pretty difficult to gauge by the naked eye.
I'm just wondering how many are actually feeling the rain at that point.
Probably a large percentage of the ones who did show up that really did not feel it after at some point.
Yeah. Well, it's the 150th running of the Preakness Stakes at Pimlico Racecourse on Saturday. And it seems like this topic of changing the Triple Crown schedule has come up about 150 times since the connections of the Kentucky Derby winner Sovereignty quickly announced that he would skip the Preakness. I mean, we talked about this last year in OMAC, and it's going to be a topic, I think, for a while before.
I think we've talked about it every year for the last who knows how many years.
Does the schedule need to change, and is there a chance that it will?
If you're trying to satisfy a lot of people that are so enthralled with a Triple Crown bid, then to them it needs to change. If I was going to argue that it needs to change, it would be not so much Triple Crown reasons as it would be you want the best horses running against each other and creating rivalries and stuff like that. And that kind of goes out the window when the best rivalry that came out of the Derby isn't going to show itself in the Preakness. So, I mean, there's a ton of theories out there. I've heard some wild ones and some sensible ones, too. I mean, Pimlico or Maryland Jockey Club that runs, you know, racing in the state actually floated the idea last year before last year's Triple Crown Series kicked off of moving the Preakness back 2 weeks, which would give you 4 weeks spacing between the Derby and the Preakness, and then only 1 week between the Preakness and the Belmont, which would be a disaster. And I'm pretty sure at the time New York Racing Association said, we have no intention of moving our race. And what that illustrates is how you have the Churchill Derby's not going anywhere for Saturday in May, the whole tradition and everything.
Yeah,
they don't need to.
No.
They don't need to because based on the spacing, the prep races leading into it, that's the perfect spot for it. However, you're dealing with two state associations and who their prized, race on the calendar any given year are kind of like they're competing against each other. You throw in the factor of they have separate broadcast partners, too, so you'd have to figure out a way to get them on board between Fox and NBC. Good luck with that. So I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon. Me personally, I don't feel any urgency to do it other than the fact that it does put a damper on the Preakness when the Derby winner doesn't show up, especially when it's a really good horse like Sovereignty this year, which kind of really has an automatic diminishing of the Preakness to some degree. And then, you know, you come back with the Belmont 3 weeks later, and we'll see who shows up for that. But there's a lot of horses waiting in the wings that are going to want to be in there.
I'll ask this silly – I know this is going to be a silly question. I'll ask it anyway.
No such thing.
Yeah. Can – it be regulated that the Kentucky winner of the Kentucky Derby must run in the Preakness?
Absolutely not. Again, it's all separate agencies. It's a problem with horse racing in general that there's no central commissioner's office or administrative body that could step forward and say, all right, we're going to change things, we're going to tweak this so that this happens. They're all their own separate fiefdoms and entities, and they're going to do what's best for themselves and their big race. Those three races are flagship moments for each of those, you know, for Kentucky, Maryland, and New York. And so, you know, it's like herding cats trying to get everybody on the same page with stuff like that. There's nobody with the authority to do that. And even if there was, I'm not so sure they would take that step because it creates a lot of other problems when you start shuffling stuff back on the calendar. I mean, you know, I'm not saying that change should never occur, but a long-winded answer to the easy answer to your original question, well, there's nobody in position to actually pull it off, so that's not going to happen that way.
I mean, isn't the safety of the horse paramount in this case? I understand. Well, I understand the Triple Crowns.
That's a good question, and when Pimlico came up with this idea, and it was just an idea that was being floated around, and somebody caught wind of it. It was sort of more like a back, you know, behind the scenes proposition. One of the reasons they said they wanted to do it was for the safety of the horses, because running 2 weeks back, you know, is not supposedly not a healthy schedule for 3-year-old thoroughbreds. I was talking to somebody about that last week, and that stance by them is pure grandstanding. They're just trying to act like they're interested in they're making this move in the interest of the safety of the horses. You're not forced to run anytime you don't want to. So if the race is coming back 2 weeks later and you don't think it's a good idea for your horse, you don't have to. You're not forced to run anytime you want. And you know, increasingly over the last, 15, 20, 30 years, especially with the 3-year-olds, trainers have been more inclined to space the races out and not run the same. I mean, you look at some of the past performances of horses back in the 60s and 70s, and they're running 15 times in a season and crazy stuff like I think Secretariat ran a race between. You can find instances where horses like ran in the Whitney between the Preakness and the Belmont when the schedule was kind of skewed that way. This isn't 1960 anymore.
Yeah.
Trainers kind of approach things. They're a little more cautious. I will say when they announced that Sovereignty wasn't going to run in the Preakness, credit to them that they announced it very quickly. They didn't leave people hanging and saying, oh, we want to see how he gallops next weekend. And they came right out on, I think it was Monday, and said, we're not doing it. They have breeding interests to think about, which is a big problem. We can get into that in great deal at a later time, but that's, I could go off for a long tangent on that. But they have breeding rights, and if they come back in the Preakness in 2 weeks and the horse bombs because 2 weeks was too quickly, now that's suddenly a blot against his resume when he becomes a stallion eventually. So they're a little careful in calculating from that side of it. So, no, I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon as far as the spacing or rescheduling. But, yeah, every time this happens – it's going to be brought up and social media is going to explode, as it always does.
Well, Sovereignty has quietly and comfortably settled in at Saratoga Racecourse. It was up there last week. Of course, you were there Saturday to see Sovereignty and trainer Bill Mott. Although Sovereignty remains in the news indirectly after jockey Junior Alvarado was fined $62,000. That's a lot of money, isn't it?
Well, it's based on a percentage of his winning percentage from his Derby. The purse is $5 million, and I can't remember the exact percentage. Like, the owner gets the biggest cut, the trainer gets a cut, the jockey gets, like, half of whatever the trainer gets, something like that. So $62,000 is based on a predetermined percentage that the Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Authority put in place. If he did the same thing in a claiming race that had a $15,000 purse, he'd be paying $62 instead of $62,000. So that's how that works. I will say that the limit that they put on hitting the horse with the stick is 6, and he went over it by 2. And immediately after the race, somebody asked him about it, somebody who had actually counted, and Junior Alvarado said, I had no idea what my number was at that point. I think generally they do, but when you're trying to win the Kentucky Derby and you got the favorite journalism breathing down your neck, you're going to do what you have to do to win that race. Yeah. $62,000 is the cost of doing business, and I'm sure the oil sheikhs in Godolphin have enough loose change in their couch that they can take care of Junior's fine for him. He's also suspended for 2 days, which I think is like the last 2 days in May, or you know, it won't affect the Belmont or anything like that. Yeah.
So what is next for Sovereignty?
Well, what is next for Sovereignty is he's going to get up on Saturday morning and eat his breakfast and go out on the track and probably not do too much like you did last Saturday when I was there. I asked Bill Mott, like, you know, what kind of breeze schedule do you want to put him on between now and the Belmont, which is June 7th. He said, I'm not even thinking that far ahead. I don't make decisions like that 2 weeks out. So he was very, you know, not forthcoming. I was wondering if he might breeze this weekend since he didn't have last weekend off, and he just refused to give any sort of committed answer at all. He'll get like two breezes in. And a breeze is a published workout where you're going to be a little more aggressive than a gallop and try to get like fitness or maintenance into them to keep them as fit as they are. He'll probably get two before the Belmont, maybe three, I don't know. But what's next for him is just eating his breakfast, going out there for a nice easy gallop, and going back and getting a bath and getting back in the stall.
Well, it looks like it's going to be another rainy week for the Triple Crown, this time in Baltimore, which handicappers should take into consideration when making their picks. So, who do you got?
I got Journalism. How could I not? I mean, it's had nothing to do with the name either. I mean, he checks all the boxes. He was the legit, worthy favorite in the Derby, ran a winning race, and just ran into a very good horse who got a better trip than he did. Journalism did have a little bit of traffic trouble at one point. Checks all the boxes. He's by Curlin, who won the Preakness, two-time horse of the year. You mentioned the rain aspect of it. I kind of went through and looked at what record the nine horses in the Preakness have on off sloppy, muddy tracks. And, you know, it was a sloppy sealed track he ran in the Derby, and you know, it doesn't appear that any kind of off track is going to affect him at all. There's a couple others in there that have run in the slop and have a little bit of experience with it. I was reading one article, I think it was in Blood Horse Magazine, that sort of examined the pedigrees of the nine horses in the field to see if there was any history of them genealogically, potentially handling an off track. And I kind of tailored my top four off of that a little bit. So I love Journalism. During the week, a couple weeks before the Derby, I was watching the morning workouts show, and he and Sovereignty were consistently raved about by everybody that saw them on the track, even if they were just galloping, not necessarily breezing. So I got Journalism on my top spot. I'm going to go with the New York bred River Thames in the number two spot, trained by Todd Pletcher, who has never won the Preakness, by the way. And as a little side local note on River Thames, who was second by a neck to Sovereignty in the Fountain of Youth at Gulfstream Park back in February. So, he's got some legit resume from a racing standpoint, but he was actually bred at CTR Stables up in Fort Edwards. So if he wins this race, I might have to take a swing up to Fort Edward and see what I can talk to up there just to kind of get that angle a little bit. Then I have Clever again, who's trained by Steve Asmussen, and he's won it with the aforementioned Curlin as well as Rachel Alexandra. He's by American Pharoah, so he's got a Triple Crown winner in his pedigree. The off-track shouldn't affect him, and his running style. Well, actually, that's a little bit of a question mark with him. But Asmussen was raving about his number eight post in the nine horse field. He and Goal Oriented from Bob Baffert are going to be the two speed horses early, and Goal Oriented is breaking from the one post. And I would be tempted to go with him to take him all the way, except Clever again, I believe my third choice is going to be breathing down his neck. And I think the distance might be a little tricky for Goal Oriented, who's very lightly raced with only two races under his belt. He actually won an allowance pretty impressively on the Derby card. And then my number four spot, I got American Promise, who was 16th in the Derby with a really troubled trip. He's trained by Dwayne Lucas, who's got seven Preakness wins, and if he wins, he'll tie Baffert, who has eight, which is a record. Lucas won it last year at the age of 88 with Seize the Gray, and he's 89 now, and he's still kicking it. He's still getting on the pony every morning. Of the four bombs that are in in double-digit odds. I like him the most. He's 15-1, so I'll stick him in the number four slot.
Of course, we mentioned it's the 150th running of the Preakness at Pimlico. This will be the last race under the current building there. They're going to demolish it. The next year's Preakness will run nearby Laurel Park in Laurel, Maryland. They're reconstructing Pimlico along the same lines as Belmont. So
yeah.
What memories do you have of Pimlico?
That's a good question. I will say this. When I'm there, when I get there on Thursday to pick up my credential and I'm there Friday and Saturday, I'll go to the barns on Friday. There's going to be a lot of pictures taken because, it is a decrepit old place, but it has a lot of history. The last few years, it might be before the pandemic, they've had the entire grandstand literally tarped off because the seats are not safe to sit in. This has nothing to do with racing, but again, it's in such a state of disrepair that the elevator broke a couple years ago, and they put up this erector set. I have photos of this on my phone still, including a video. It's an erector set, four-story, like basically cargo elevator on the outside of the grandstand that takes you up to the roof, and then you have to walk across the roof to a door that lets you into a hallway to get to the press box. The press box is really cool. Again, it's old. Reminds me of Boston Garden. We used to go there before they tore that down. The flooring, in that one hallway is sort of like a funhouse at the, at the carnival. It's kind of old linoleum tiles that sort of wind around and everything. They have photos up on the walls of past Preakness winners. As far as horse racing wise, I remember American Pharoah, I think it was rainy that day too. And I was watching that from out by the eighth pole, so I didn't really get to see him at the finish. But I was fortunate to see two horses who eventually went on to win the Triple Crown, including Justify as well in 2018. So, I mean, those are probably the two biggies. Then, of course, when they won the Belmont, that was even more memorable. I'll miss the old Pimlico just because you're attached to it, and I'm kind of like old school traditional. But I saw some artist renderings of it just a little while ago, and I like what they did as far as retaining some old school look to it. It's got a very historic look as opposed to Belmont, which looks like an ocean liner. It looks like the Love Boat, what they're building down there. But two things are happening in parallel, and there's a lot of other like side ancillary stuff that's going on with Pimlico. It's nice to see the state of Maryland has made a very strong commitment to keeping the Preakness at Pimlico.
Yeah, how important is that?
It's very important because, for one thing, Laurel Park, I've never been there, but my understanding is that, and it's down closer to like D.C., it was built and they're run by the same company, First One ST, which is the former Frank Stronach Group. And from everything I've heard, Laurel was built to basically be a party site for people in D.C. to get away for the weekend. And the race, they don't really have any significant racing there. And Pimlico, they only run 15 racing days all year. But when they get the new one built and all the other cool stuff that they're going to have, like dorms and barns and things like that, they're going to have probably about 100 racing days at Pimlico over the calendar year. So I'm looking forward to it. And again, the pictures I saw of it, it looks really cool. It looks like historic, old school architecture and stuff like that. I kind of wish Naira had done that with Elma.
Yeah. Well, you can follow Mike's coverage on X at Mike_McGadden, of course, dailygazette.com, and the print edition with his coverage of Preakness. And Mike, enjoy it and stay dry down in Baltimore.
Thanks, Ken. Everybody bet journalism, although you're not going to get a price.
That's Mike McGadden. We're back to wrap up the podcast and have the latest winner in the Daily Gazette's auto racing contest in just a moment.
Explore the benefits of subscribing to the Daily Gazette, like our convenient e-edition app, personalized newsletters, and unique reader rewards when you join. Start your membership today. Offers redeemable at www.dailygazette.com.
To every referee, umpire, and judge in high school sports, we want to say, we see you.
We see everything you do for us that goes unnoticed.
We see the positive role models that you are.
We see the way you get unfairly criticized just for doing your job.
The truth is, we couldn't play without you.
So thank you for investing your time in us.
Thank you for protecting the integrity of the game, no matter what.
We hope you always know how much we appreciate you.
Because without you, this is just recess. It's not really a game.
Thank you for always making it possible for us to play the sports we love.
Want to serve the students in your community? Sign up to become an official in New York at highschoolofficials.com.
Hi, this is Greg Floyd, Emmy Award-winning, they made me say that, news anchor at CBS 6 in Schenectady. You're listening to the Parting Shots podcast with my friend, Daily Gazette sports editor, Ken Schatz.
Back to wrap up the podcast, and before I give you the latest winner in the Daily Gazette's auto racing contest, I'm putting this podcast together on 5:15, and if you are fans of The Who and a fan of the Quadrophenia soundtrack, that's a song on that soundtrack, 5:15. I'm out of my brain on the 5:15, so happy 5:15 day, everybody. The Week 12 winner in the Daily Gazette's auto racing contest was Kathleen Bellinger of Johnstown with 75 points. Kathleen wins a $50 gift card. Congratulations, Kathleen. The VIP winner was Jerry Peel of Frankensons with 35 points. Looking at the VIP standings, Scott Lusher of Capital Land GMC leads with 215 points. Jerry Peel is second with 185. Dwayne Leach of All Seasons Equipment is third with 175 points. Nick Platel of Grand Premier Tire in fourth with 165. I'm slipping. I'm at 160. And Matt Margiotta of S&G Roofing has 75 points. I'll announce the auto racing contest winner's name, and that winner's name will appear in Saturday's Daily Gazette. To play, go to dailygazette.com and click on the auto racing contest banner. Just because COVID-19 mandates are easing, that does not mean you should relax. Be vigilant. If you have not gotten vaccinated or received a booster shot, please do so. Do it for yourself, do it for your family, and do it for your friends. And a friendly reminder, vaccines do not cause autism. Don't forget to download the Daily Gazette app and sign up for our e-edition so you never miss a headline. Subscribe today at www.dailygazette.com. We have a lot of great specials going on. When credibility matters, trust the Daily Gazette. On the latest edition of the Stan and Shen Show, the pair talk about the High School Musical Theater Awards at Proctor's, High School Rowing Championships, the chance to get Shen into a racing shell this summer, and her spending another week covering the courts. Subscribe to the Stan and Shen Show on all your podcast listening platforms. That wraps up another edition of the Parting Shots podcast. I want to thank Carl Ravitch and Mike McAdam for coming on the show. If you have questions or comments about the podcast, email them to me at Schott, that's S-C-H-O-T-T, at dailygazette.com. Follow me on X, Threads, and Blue Sky at Slapshots. The views expressed on the Parting Shots podcast are not necessarily those of the Daily Gazette Company. The Parting Shots podcast is a production of the Daily Gazette Company. I am Daily Gazette sports editor Ken Schott. Thanks for listening, and I'll catch you next time. From the Parting Shots podcast studio in Schenectady, New York, good day. Good sports.